its current state on 90.5 WKAR. A quick reminder that we are nearing the end of our fiscal year here at WKAR, and it's an opportunity to make an investment in national public radio programming and in current state here on WKAR. Your tax-deductible gift to WKAR will help guarantee the daily broadcast of your favorite commercial-free programming and help keep Mid-Michigan Radio strong here on WKAR. Make your gift now. Go to WKAR.org and give on click on the Give Now link, and many thanks. Coming up on today's program, I'm told that the corpse flower has bloomed at Michigan State. We'll tell you a little bit more about that later on. This extraordinary plant blooms infrequently and unpredictably. And we are told that it bloomed last night. We'll give a little bit more information on that, because some people actually want to run over there and see this while it's in bloom. It's also the anniversary of an air tragedy that took place over Lake Michigan 64 years ago today. Northwest Flight 2501 went down, and a great deal is still not known about that incident 64 years later. Peter Worf talks with an expert on that coming up. At the top of our program, the tension between supporters of traditional schools and charter schools in Michigan has intensified. That's because of recent stories in the Detroit Free Press, which raise serious doubts about the operation and oversight of the state's nearly 400 charter schools. Public revenue that underwrites Michigan charter schools amounts to nearly $1 billion a year, according to the story. The paper's Jennifer Dixon writes, quote, "Taxpayers and parents are left clueless about how charter schools spend the public's money," unquote. In its review of 20 years of charter school records, the Free Press also found instances of wasteful spending, poor academic performance, a lack of regulation, and resistance to reform. The issue becomes more complicated since a number of Michigan charter schools appear to be run well and doing a very good job. Quite a few serve minorities living in poverty. Two guests rejoin us today to respond to some of the issues raised in the articles. Amber Arellano is Executive Director of EdTrust Midwest, a nonpartisan education advocacy and research organization based in Ann Arbor. Amber, welcome back.
Thank you.
And rejoining us as well, the superintendent of a successful Lansing charter school, Brian Shaughnessy, has been with the city's Cole Academy since 2010. He also spent 14 years in public school teaching and administration. Brian Shaughnessy, welcome back.
Thank you.
The articles are scathing in terms of abuses by for-profit management companies that are at a number of charter schools, especially regarding transparency over how they spend public money. It also says that Michigan has more of these for-profit management companies running charter schools than a number of other states, and that often the boards that run the schools let the management companies, quote, handle the money and make the decisions, unquote. Amber Arellano, is this a problem from your perspective? Is this situation on your radar?
Yeah, it is, and it has been for a few years now. You know, Michigan is very unusual for the things that you were talking about, the characteristics of its charter school sector. We have one of the largest percentages of for-profit management companies running charter schools, and some of them do a really terrific job. Some of them are really providing students high-quality schooling. They're providing better options and choices that kids would not have had in their neighborhoods without that school. Unfortunately, as the Free Press is pointing out, there are lots of other ones, though, that there's some very mysterious and obviously now the Free Press is showing concerning practices. You know, millions of dollars not being accounted for, people wondering, you know, trying to figure out where money is going and saying, look, these are public dollars. And, you know, we think we ought to be able to really know as parents, as civic leaders, as community leaders. And when companies say, well, no, I mean, we're a private company, you know, these records aren't privy to FOIA, it just raises suspicions for people.
Let's visit with Brian Shaughnessy here of Lansing's Cole Academy. about this particular issue. Is Cole run by a for-profit management company, Brian?
No, it's not, Mark. We're the board runs the show. The board, it's a self-managed, independent board. We do have some a la carte HR stuff that we do farm out. I think it's kind of important to realize when we start lumping charter schools and traditional schools and make these broad comments that it's just really not fair. It just seems that there's been a number of issues over the last 20 years, 30 years, 40 years back east here with traditional schools, and you could take those same comments about mismanagement and funds and taxpayer dollars and transfer them to a traditional school conversation. They've come up with the same problems. Metro Detroit, River Rouge, East Detroit, Pontiac, Farmington, Oakland Public Schools, they've all had these issues over the last, you know, I looked that up yesterday, it took me 5 minutes.
Amber, what do you make of that? I mean, is it really as mixed a landscape as Brian Shaughnessy suggests?
Well, I mean, it's a sort of same and different, right? I mean, so on one hand, I think Brian's absolutely right in that both the traditional public school sector and the charter sector both have a lot of variation in terms of quality, and both sectors, you know, have lots of high performers, mediocre schools, and then schools that are struggling, and you know, schools that have problems with corruption and others that don't. One of the things that's different about the charter sector is, as you were pointing out earlier, is that because we have it's so dominated in Michigan by for-profits, it's unusual when some of those companies, you know, don't abide by the same sort of laws and spirit of transparency that traditional public schools or even a nonprofit charter school might abide by. I think the other thing that we have to keep in mind, too, is that the Free Press really highlights strongly is that when the charter school movement opened in Michigan in the early 90s, it promised to offer better options than what children could find in traditional public schools. So the promise was that if you give us more flexibility, less regulation, less oversight, we promise to deliver better for students and for especially for poor children. And the problem is, and I think that for us, this is the thing that's the most concerning thing is that unfortunately many of those schools are not only not providing a better option, they're actually often providing a worse option. So we're spending now about $1 billion annually on these schools, and in many cases the schools are absolutely abysmal in terms of academic performance. And I mean, even when you compare them to other schools that are serving predominantly kids of color or low-income students, right? I mean, for some schools are far underperforming our worst public school districts in the state, including Flint Public Schools and Detroit Public Schools. So, you know, when an operator is chronically underperforming some of the worst and most troubled public school districts in the country, we've got to really kind of take a look at that and say, you know, that's not why the charter sector was created in Michigan. And we've got to figure out ways that we can strengthen the sector, you know, increase that transparency and build the sector. And, you know, for folks that are running great schools like Cole Academy in Lansing, how do we replicate more of those schools in Michigan rather than the ones that are doing so badly?
Well, that's a good question, Amber, and I'd like to answer it. First of all, we had some, I wouldn't say limited success. We're seeing some real positive trends, and I'm always a shameless self-promoter for Cole Academy, but I won't get into the numbers, how we beat some local top schools in the state last year and 25% increases in different things. I won't get into those details. but to answer your question, no one has called the school to see what we're doing better. You know, and no one called to say, gee, how did you do that last year or this year? And I don't know why that is, because when I came into the district and when I met with the board, who's very supportive, I called the top schools in the state. I asked them what they were doing. And you look at the best practices for the National Council of Teacher Mathematics, the National Council of Teachers of English. It's not a mystery in how to run a great school. It's, you know, been doing this research for 20 years. Dewey's been talking it since the 50s. We know what to do. We just need to do it.
You think charter schools are getting a bad rap here, Brian?
Well, I don't think you could lump charter schools into, you know, it's like comparing Hazlitt to Lansing. I mean, does Hazlitt step on the podium and talk about how Lansing's doing, or Lansing talk about how they're doing better than somebody else? It's just not a fair comparison. There's a variety of options in the charter school industry, and management of schools that has not been discussed at all. It's just been all been lumped in. For instance, you have a board superintendent staff. They all work for the board. You have a, you have an independent board that hires out a separate superintendent from a different HR company, and they supervise the staff. You have HR. I mean, there's just so many different things in different schools. So in one way, I do agree we should be able to vet out these schools, either help them, I think, and they can be helped, and do what we can, or not. I mean, and that's the question. But once you start lumping traditional and charter schools, it's every one of these schools is takes on a life of its own, and it comes down to the board having the option of keeping these companies. They do have contracts. They do run out. If they're not performing well, then somebody has to make some tough decisions, and I think that's what the biggest problem is.
We're talking about Michigan charter schools today. Our guests on Current State, Brian Shaughnessy, superintendent of Lansing's Cole Academy Charter School, and Amber Arellano, executive director of EdTrust Midwest, an education policy organization based in Ann Arbor. Let's talk about authorizers, because every charter school has an authorizer. The Free Press articles go into this in some depth. In Michigan, charter schools are often authorized by public state universities, but they can also be authorized by school districts and community colleges. And the article suggests these authorizers sometimes continue to grant more charters to operators that are underperforming or failing, and that too little genuine oversight is provided by the authorizers. Amber Arellano, what do you make in general of the relationships between authorizers and the boards that run charter schools?
Yeah, so this is a huge issue. It's a huge problem in Michigan. We're in a very unusual state for both the number of authorizers that we have and for the lack of oversight that we have over authorizers. In fact, I mean, you know, no one really can hold our authorizers accountable in Michigan. If Governor Snyder said, you know, I'm really concerned about X authorizer and its practices, and I wanna regulate that authorizer. I mean, not the governor doesn't even have that kind of authority right now, and that's very unusual compared to leading education states like Massachusetts, like Minnesota, where the standards for opening and expansion are very high. And I just want to give an example, if I may. So Stanford University has come out with a series of reports that gives apples-to-apples comparisons about performance, not only charter schools compared to charter schools, but traditional public schools to charter schools. And it's really trying to get at, you know, once we consider for poverty, which unfortunately we know does have a negative impact on performance, how are our charter schools doing across the country? And what they found in Michigan was that there are many charter schools that are outperforming traditional public schools, and they're fantastic. And thank goodness that they're open and they're providing those options for those kids. Unfortunately, we do have some very, very, really some of the worst performing operators in the country, and we have authorizers continuing to allow them to expand. In fact, we have operators that are performing so low that they've shown negative student growth in these Stanford University reports. But we have authorizers continuing to allow them to expand and take on more students.
Let's give Brian Shaughnessy a chance to weigh in here. Central Michigan University is your authorizer at Cole Academy, correct? Talk about the relationship between your board and CMU.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I can't speak upon, you know, the schools and the authorizers she's talking about. I can only go from my own experience. I'd like to see a traditional school do the required reports that I have to do for Central Michigan University. As far as I'm concerned, they do a good job. Keep in mind, I have no relationship with them other than they come in and they make sure that we do compliance reports. I have a master calendar that has about 5 to 10 tasks each month that I have to make sure that I do. We post our minutes of our board meetings. We post our agenda. We make sure that timelines are done, you know, posted 10, 15 days, whatever the requirements are ahead of time. We do a public hearing for our budget. We have an auditor come in to do our books every year, which costs the board quite a bit of money. I mean, there's a lot of – when you say compliance, I mean, these are things that the CMU and the authorizers are making sure schools do. They don't do that in public schools. That doesn't happen.
It sounds like there's a framework here, Amber, for things to be done right.
Correct.
But it is simply when it comes to on the ground operations, when it comes to the peculiarities of the authorizers, when it comes to the idiosyncrasies of the boards, of the staffs, there's all kinds of variation.
There's not just one thing, and that's an important point.
Yeah.
Well, there is, and there is a lot of variation, and that's normal, right? I mean, just as there's variation.
But how do we get ahead? How do we get ahead here, though? What is the way ahead?
For example, they wouldn't. I mean, so you know, Cole Academy is obviously it's one of the good schools out there. But let's say Cole had been failing for more than a decade, and its students were doing so badly that they would actually be far better off, twice as likely to read in the Detroit Public Schools than at Cole Academy. So in a place like Massachusetts, there would be state standards in place, right, that would ensure that the authorizer of Cole Academy, you know, not only was it giving that school more support to improve, but at the very least, that authorizer wasn't saying, gosh, Cole, you know, you're doing so badly, we actually want you to open up three more schools because we want you to fail 7,000 more students.
Yeah, well, you're getting.
We want to put Michigan taxpayers' money into that in that kind of a failure.
Well, you're getting really. You're getting really specific.
Quality standards that they have for expansion, right? And so it's not.
Amber, you had cut me. You had cut me off the last. Amber, you talked over me the last time I was here. I'm not going to be able to do that this time. You talked over me the last time.
Let's give Brian a chance to respond to that.
Amber, you know, you got really specific here at our school, and I appreciate that. But that's what people need to do. You need to start getting specific about the specific individual schools that are having a problem, and you address those problems. Now, those are difficult things to do, and people might have to be fired, and tough decisions might have to be made. But that's what you need to do. Hit specific schools that need to be fixed, not address all charter schools do this and all charter schools do that. And just like all traditional schools can't be lumped into that same category, charter schools need the same courtesy. And we are a public school. We're required to do state reports. I have auditors coming in from the state, Title I. I have compliance things that I have to do for the state and for the federal government that we're required to do just like every other public school in the country.
Brian, you've done a good job, I think, of pointing out the complexities in this landscape. What would you say is the way ahead, briefly?
Well, the state's doing a good job, and I think you know, the MDE of identifying these schools, and quite frankly, it's no mystery in how to have a great school. It just really isn't. And if you look at best practices and effective school correlates, and you look at all the research and Jeffrey Canada, I mean, we know what to do. We just need to do it.
Do we need more transparency, though, Brian, in terms
of
how dollars are spent?
Of course. We're required to put our transparency in our budget on the year just like every other public school. And the bottom line is that the Board of Education is the ultimate one making these decisions. Now, somebody signed up with these companies years ago and sold the farm. Now, you know, that, and they have contracts. So if that's a problem, there's wasteful spending or money, I can't speak on it. I'm not part of that situation. But get specific about those specific schools, no specific wasteful things, not lumping charter schools and all these other issues into one basket.
We have just scratched the surface of a big, sprawling, important topic. We want to thank both of our guests. Amber Arellano is Executive Director of EdTrust Midwest in Ann Arbor, and Brian Shaughnessy is the Superintendent of the Lansing Charter School, the Cole Academy. Amber and Brian, thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. This weekend, the Great Lakes Renewable Energy Association will hold its 10th annual Michigan Energy Fair at the Ingham County Fairgrounds. There will be exhibitions and workshops on energy efficiency, alternative energy, and sustainable living practices. Current state Scott Pohl is here with more on the man who will give the keynote address on Saturday. Hi, Scott. Who is David Millark?
David Millark is the co-founder of the Archangel Ancient Tree Archive. He has three stated goals: propagate old growth trees before they're gone, archive the genetics of ancient trees, and reforest the earth.
Archangel Ancient Trees is going around country by country and searching for the largest, oldest living trees of each species and cloning the largest and oldest species of trees and preserving their genetics. We're making a genetic ark. But on our ark, instead of the animals, we're putting the last tree genetics of the world And then after we archive those genetics country by country, we're giving those countries the ability to, we can produce millions and millions of these trees to help reforest and reestablish the filter system for our air and our water and go after climate change. That's what Archangel Ancient Trees is doing.
Is the idea to replenish forests, or is it to move a species of trees from one place to another, or to try to start new growth where there wasn't before of a certain species of tree?
Well, that's an excellent question. There's two answers. What you're referring to, moving trees, is called assisted migration. As we go deeper and deeper into climate change and their effects, most native trees, region by region, are really suffering from drought and heat. So with assisted migration, we clone those trees and move them north to where it's cooler and more moist, what their natural range will be, because the trees can't move quick enough to get out of harm's way. Here in the United States, we've cut down 98% of our old-growth forest. We only have 2% of that old-growth forest left, which was the backbone of the infrastructure of all ecosystems here in the United States. So basically, we've destroyed the filter system of the aquarium, and we're asking the fish and the plants and the water of the aquarium to try and survive on their own without a filter system. So at Archangel Ancient Trees, we recognize that it's mandatory that we put back the natural filter system for our water, for our air, and also to start to sequester and offset the excess carbon in our atmosphere, and it can and it will do that.
Sometimes when an animal species or a plant species is introduced where it didn't used to exist, they wind up flourishing to a greater extent than you might have expected. Some would consider them to become an invasive species. Is that a concern at all in your project?
Yes, invasive species is a real concern. But like with the redwoods and sequoias and 100 different species of trees that we've chosen around the world to use, they don't travel. They stay put. The species of trees that we have selected, the animals and birds don't spread them through, and then also through the wind, their seeds. So where we put them, they stay put. And basically what we do is we look for the right tree in the right place for each individual project that we do in each region of each country. So yes, that is a job one priority and consideration. But you have to bear in mind, too, it's like here in Michigan. We're losing all of our beaches through disease. We've lost a dozen major tree species that were native to Michigan through various introduced diseases, through climate change, through SO2 excesses, acid rain in the air. So we need to be intelligent, and we need to select species that will be able to take the climate as it adjusts hotter and drier here in Michigan, as well as all over the world, Scott.
We're talking with David Millark of the Archangel Ancient Tree Archive, and I'd like to ask you about the science of how this works, because when people think about propagating tree species, they think of seeds and seedlings, maybe acorns or pine cones, that sort of thing. But you used the word cloning. Can you tell me more about how this works?
Yes, it's very simple, Scott. A seedling or a tree from seed is 50% genetically that of the parent tree. You don't always know, or very seldom do you know, which tree has cross-pollinated with that tree and where it could be from hundreds of miles away. The species of tree that cross-pollinated with that tree to make the seed viable. What we're doing is we're saving the last 2% of this country's known, genetically known for tens of thousands of years, the largest, hardiest, and strongest genetics of those trees that are 100% the fingerprint, genetic fingerprint of that tree. It is that tree, Scott. It's not very close or very, very similar. It is extending the life of that tree on so the genetics can be studied and utilized.
You mentioned a large number of species of trees that you work with, but in looking at your website a little bit, there seemed to be a bit of a focus perhaps on two different species. I'd like to ask you about the coast redwood and the Hippocrates sycamore. Can you tell me more about them?
Yes, the Hippocrates sycamore was a Mediterranean sycamore brought over to this country in the 50s by the government of Greece. It is a clone of the tree Hippocrates he himself planted on the island of Kos 2,000 years ago and began the science of medicine under, or he started teaching medicine, that's the genesis of medicine, under that tree. The government of Greece gave a few of these trees out to, like, the National Institute of Health, some university medical schools, and we were asked, as they started to decline and die, could we try and clone these to make these available, like we just did at the University of Michigan, the National Institute of Health, or anyone or any organization that would like a clone or the exact copy of the tree that Hippocrates himself planted. We've taken that on as a project. Now, on the coast redwoods and giant sequoias, the reason that we're working with those is quite simply, they're the most iconic, beloved species of tree on Earth. Wherever you travel around the world, people know redwoods, they revere redwoods, but also what most people don't understand is redwoods are among the very fastest growing species of trees on Earth, which means they suck up and store carbon better than almost any species of trees on the planet. So we're proponents of building groves of coast redwoods and giant sequoias all over the world in all the climates that they'll thrive, and using them as carbon sinks and really going after reversing the effects of climate change or excess carbon in our atmosphere. They're the leaders of the battle of the fight to reverse climate change, so to speak, in the natural world. That's what Archangel Ancient Tree has done. I think we've planted now coast redwoods and giant sequoias in 8 or 9 different countries. And they're thriving and doing well.
Are they typically planted on public lands? Are there private landowners who are bringing you in?
This week, we are shipping 300 exact genetic clones of the largest and oldest coast redwoods alive today to the Eden Project in England. The Eden Project is an environmental group, and I would advise anyone to Google up the Eden Project. It's a huge environmental organizations in England, and they would like to plant a grove of coast redwoods as a model, and as a kickoff, we will start the UK collection with Eden later on this summer, going all over the UK, species by species, and finding and cloning the largest and oldest of all the different species, and then archiving those genetics at the Eden Project. Another project this week that's going to be shipped is we're going to build the second old-growth redwood forest ever built. Archangel built the first one, and this will be in southern Oregon. And the reason southern Oregon is because it's north of the range, it's still cool and moist there, and it's our best guess, our best shot at preserving the coast redwoods, which are really suffering. All the trees in California, because of the 3 or 4 years of tremendous drought and heat, we're really at risk of losing the redwoods and the giant sequoias. So we're putting them out of harm's danger, Scott. In the southern Oregon, we found a spot that it is cool, it's moist, more like their native range.
It's kind of amazing to hear someone utter the phrase, building a redwood forest.
Correct. Well, that hasn't been possible until recently, because if you're going to build or rebuild a redwood forest, first off, you have to have clones of the largest, oldest redwoods that are still alive. In some cases, we've brought stumps back to life, which those trees were much bigger than anything alive today. So you have to have the basic building components, which are the trees themselves. And we have a combination of about 70 different coast redwoods of the largest and oldest that ever lived and are alive today. We clone those, we make several hundred of those copies of each, and we put them where they will do well for the next couple thousand years, in our best guess, and we start to reforest using the genetics of these ancient trees. So you really are rebuilding and building the world's first old growth forest.
We're talking with David Millark of the Archangel Ancient Tree Archive, and I have to ask you, when we're talking about trees like redwoods, which people associate with California, why are you in Copamish, Michigan?
Why am I in Copamish, Michigan? Because I am the fourth generation here. My sons, who are both active in the project, Jared and Jake, are the fifth generation. And our grandchildren, who live on our family land, are the sixth generation now here in this little village of Copamish. So it's where we've been. It's where we are. It looks like we're going to be here for a long time into the future also. But we have been in the tree business since 1964. So it's a family business that has expanded to a national, international body of work. And by the way, Archangel is a nonprofit. All the trees that we produce, we give away, believe it or not. We ask for financial support to do that. We have a new book out, The Man Who Planted Trees. It's by Jim Robbins. And Jim Robbins has been a New York Times science reporter for 25 years. He followed us around all over the country and Europe, and he wrote a book, The Man Who Planted Trees. And there's some astounding new science that Jim has brought forward on what trees really do. They're not just a commodity, and they're not just firewood, and they're not just two-by-fours. The critical roles that trees play in all of our lives, in all living things' lives, including our oceans and our mammals. By cutting down the world's old-growth forest, we have really put ourselves as human beings in a precarious position. And we've put our survivability of our grandchildren at risk, and we didn't even know that. We went ahead and cut down most all of the world's old-growth forests before we even studied them. We cut them all down before we even preserved the mother trees so that they could reproduce themselves or assisted production of old growth forests. We just, all we saw was dollar signs, and we dove in, and we still are, going for the fastest, quickest buck without really taking into consideration how necessary trees really are in all of our lives.
David Millark is the co-founder of the Archangel Ancient Tree Archive. He'll give the keynote address on Saturday at 11 in the morning to the Great Lakes Renewable Energy Association's 2014 Michigan Energy Fair at the Ingham County Fairgrounds in Mason. David Millark, thank you.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And Current State producer Joel Lindstroth says MSU's corpse flower has bloomed. In case you didn't catch our segment yesterday about this plant, the corpse flower, it blooms infrequently, unpredictably, and briefly. The corpse flower bloomed last night at MSU's Plant Biology Conservatory, Wilson and Farm Lane, and the public can view it today from 10 until 7 p.m. And if you're really fond of lilacs, this may not be the plant for you. It's called a corpse flower because its fragrance, if that's the word, is akin to a rotting corpse. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the end of each month, we check in with Great Lakes commentator and journalist Gary Wilson for updates on environmental stories from around the Great Lakes Basin. For today's Great Lakes Month in Review, we're focusing on the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. This group includes 114 mayors of cities throughout the Great Lakes Basin who focus on environmental issues. Gary Wilson, welcome back.
Hey, Mark, good morning. How are you?
Just fine, thank you. Tell us just a little bit more about this organization, the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative.
Sure, Mark. Like you said, it's 114 cities and around the Great Lakes region and also the St. Lawrence River. They were formed about 10 years ago, essentially by Mayor Daley from Chicago and the mayor of Toronto. I believe his last name was Miller. I may be wrong on that. They saw a need for cities to engage on environmental issues, especially related to water. The mayors perceived that they're right on the front lines of a lot of these problems and a lot of the issues going on in the Great Lakes, and they wanted to have a voice. So they formed this organization, and they're very appropriately aggressive. They're engaged. They want to influence policy, and they're not afraid to speak out and flex their muscles. And that's what they were doing at their annual meeting, which took place in Thunder Bay, Ontario, last week.
What were some of the major topics of discussion?
Two big ones, Mark. Climate change, which seems to be on everybody's radar. For them, climate change, adaptation, how do we adapt to it, not does it exist. They acknowledge and agree that it exists and is impacting their cities. And what do we do about it? What do they do about it? Adaptation, and how do they become resilient? The big topic there. I was able to speak with Mayor Keith Hobbs from Thunder Bay, and he was the host, and he's also the director of the organization, and we talked quite a bit about it. And one of the questions I asked Mayor Hobbs was, you know, focusing on climate change isn't really a traditional role for mayors. Mayors do things like take care of police and fire. They take care of schools. They take care of parks, those types of things. I said, do you get feedback from your constituents, who are the voters who have to elect you, saying, "Gee, why don't you fix the roads and take care of the schools and let the big guys focusing on climate change issues?" And Mayor Hobbs was very direct. He said that used to be the case until 2012. In 2012, Thunder Bay experienced what he called a 100-year storm, and it wiped out 5,000 homes, flooded the wastewater treatment facility. They've incurred $45 million in expense, and they've been sued by citizens, class action suit, for failure to adapt to climate change. Mayor Hobbs has a reputation for being very direct, and he said, there's your answer. So,
What's one of the more talked about adaptations?
Well, they've trying to figure out what to do with stormwater and two issues. One is they're requesting federal support from both the federal governments, U.S. and Canada, for infrastructure issues like stormwater and wastewater. But this group isn't one to just sit on its hands and go to the feds and say, give us money and help us. They're also very focused on green initiatives, trying to keep the water where it lands versus running off into the sewers and causing problems. So green roofs, porous pavements, rain gardens, rain barrels, anything they can do to keep the water where it lands, which is the best solution. But they also recognize that for some time that will not be enough. So they're requesting federal help for infrastructure projects.
Gary Wilson is our guest. It's our annual our monthly Great Lakes Month in Review segment here. I know that the transport of oil across the Great Lakes was another topic of discussion at this gathering. What was the thrust of that discussion?
Yes, Mark, that's very high up on their agenda. And you and I have talked about the oil transport on the Great Lakes becoming an increasing issue. And the mayors are really concerned about this. It's generated by the fact that this transport of oil through pipelines, potentially on the Great Lakes and tankers, any other means, rail cars, is only going to increase as the oil production out west increases. They're keying off of two incidents, tragic incidents. One is the Kalamazoo oil spill through via the Enbridge pipeline, and the other one was the very tragic Lac Magenti Quebec rail car derailment, which killed 47 people. And they're going to the federal governments, again, of both countries and saying that we have inadequate oversight and inadequate regulation, and these risks are right in our towns. So they're taking a pretty strong stance, asking for federal intervention to try to ensure the safety as best as it can be for the towns. Mm. You know, many of the Great Lakes cities have these rail cars going right through them, as witnessed by the Lac Magenti accident. They did stop short of calling for a ban on tar sands crude being shipped on the Great Lakes. It's not currently happening, when I say on the Great Lakes, I mean literally on the Great Lakes. That was a little bit disappointing. I thought they might take a little stronger position there. But they do have some aggressive things that they're calling for related to safety, so we'll have to see how the federal government handles that.
And I know Asian carp was also a topic of discussion. Where did the mayors stand on that?
Well, this is kind of a stealth issue. They're very much, the mayors are very much, Mark, in favor of physical separation from the Great Lakes for the Great Lakes from the Mississippi. Again, another topic that we've mentioned a number of times. Now, since the Army Corps released its report in January, you know, the thing is kind of stalled. There's just no, there's no initiative. There's no leadership. As Governor Snyder mentioned a couple of months ago, we lack, as a region, we lack a sense of urgency. So the mayors want to take a leadership position on this, and they want to try to facilitate a discussion that leads to a consensus. They understand that it's going to be hard, but right now, you know, the project to do anything is just sort of dead in the water.
All right.
They secured some funding, and they're going to try to move things along.
Gary Wilson is a Great Lakes commentator and journalist. Gary, many thanks for your time.
Always good to be with you, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. On June 24, 1950, Northwest Airlines Flight 2501 left New York City for Seattle. The state-of-the-art DC-4 aircraft was to stop in Minneapolis for refueling before proceeding to the West Coast. Monitoring the plane in threatening weather over Lake Michigan, air controllers lost track of the flight. The aircraft was never recovered, nor were any passengers or crew. Further wreckage discovered some days later indicated a total loss. Valerie Van Heest is a Holland-based diver, shipwreck historian, and author of the recent book, Fatal Crossing, The Mysterious Disappearance of NWA Flight 2501 and the Quest for Answers. Van Heest spoke with WKAR's Peter Wharf about today's 64th anniversary of the tragedy and the parallels with a more recent aviation mystery.
Today's search for Malaysia Airlines, I'm certain that won't end until there are some answers uncovered. There were so many things that were similar. It was haunting for me 3 months ago when Malaysia disappeared because the similarities were confounding. Both planes were missing for a period of time. People wondered, was it a hijacking? Was it a bombing? Was it an accident? Was weather involved? And all those things went through people's minds in 1950. The difference was here in Lake Michigan, after 3 days, we did discover wreckage floating on the surface of the lake, and it confirmed the tragedy. We don't have any such confirmation with Malaysia.
It appears from your article, Lost Over Lake Michigan, from the recent issue of Michigan History magazine, that weather was likely involved or could have played a part in some case. Can you sort of recall the story of that takeoff from LaGuardia Airport in New York City with Captain Robert Lind?
Sure, absolutely. Well, it was June 23rd, early evening, and 58 people, including three crew members, the pilot Robert Lind and the co-pilot Vern Wolf and the stewardess Bonnie Ann Feldman. And it was a normal flight cross-country. It was going to arrive About 18 hours later in Seattle, initially with a stop in Minneapolis. And the pilot was aware that there was a storm brewing over the Lake Michigan, moving through the Midwest. He took action to try to fly under the storm, requesting clearances along the way to go lower. But his final clearance when he was over Lake Michigan, his request to go from 3,500 to 2,500 was denied, supposedly due to other traffic over the lake. Well, we don't know if that denial contributed to the accident. We don't know if the pilot might have tried going down under storm clouds. Anyhow, it was his prerogative to do whatever he thought was safe, despite what air traffic control might tell him. But without further communication, without any notice from him of problems, the plane simply vanished. All these years later, after 10 years of research, prompted largely by our desire, my team's desire to find this wreck and solve the mystery that the government wasn't able to solve, all that research has now given us a much better idea of what happened that night, although you know, there are some aspects of this mystery that still linger.
This is Peter Worf for Current State on WKAR. I'm speaking with Valerie Van Heest, author of the book Fatal Crossing, The Mysterious Disappearance of Northwest Airlines Flight 2501 and the Quest for Answers, and also author of the recent article Lost Over Lake Michigan from Michigan History Magazine. Tell me about your team's recent research and finding out more information about Flight 2501.
Well, when we set out on any quest, whether looking for this particular airplane or looking for shipwrecks like we have done now for the last dozen years, we start by researching these accidents, the vessels, the people on board, the protocol in situations like this. And in this case, I was looking for, I call it the smoking gun. I was looking for one little bit of information that might point us to the one spot on Lake Michigan where this accident happened. And in the course of that research, I instead found families of the victims who, after all these years, were still looking for closure. And I wasn't used to this. Usually when we're searching for a shipwreck, it might have happened 100 or 150 years ago, and there typically aren't people alive who knew the victim. Well, this was a relatively modern accident, and over the space of about 6 years, I connected with 51 of the 58 families, and each one of them had memories of that day, receiving the news, the follow-up from the airline and the government. And my contacting them brought all these memories back to the forefront. And now they're anxiously awaiting a discovery one day that might help solve this.
Yes, one of the most poignant things about your recent magazine article was the full page of photographs of all the people who were lost in the accident. And you can see their faces.
Yes. And one by one, they've come to me. The families have sent the photographs and told the stories. And they were ordinary people like you and I, traveling either on business or vacation or to see family. And their lives were just cut short. The youngest person was a young boy, 3 years old, Dana Malby, who lost his life. So what we remember by now studying this is the people, and we're reminded that accidents do happen, and it gives us a sort of a gauge to live our own lives, to never go to bed angry, and to accomplish our goals in as quick an order as we can. So all kinds of things have come out of the study of this accident, and I think most importantly, what I try to bring out in my book is that we can learn from past accidents. Now, none of us fly, well, a few of us out there, listeners, are probably pilots, but most of us in planes are in the back, and we can't affect what happens, you know, flying. However, so many of us are in cars every day, and we make decisions, and sometimes those decisions lead to accidents. And I think that what I've learned in the course of writing this book and studying this accident is that each decision we make in our everyday lives and in our, you know, particularly on the road, we make decisions that may lead to accidents. And what we've learned now about this particular accident, it was the culmination of a lot of problems, like most accidents. In this case, we know that Robert Lynn's clearance to go under the weather was denied. We learned that the flight advisory station that's supposed to transmit weather information to pilots, it was down that evening. We also learned that while many other pilots chose to turn back and wait out the storm, Robert Lynn, for some reason, chose to go ahead, a real risk. That obviously contributed to this accident. And we also know that Northwest Airlines now didn't convey the weather information to the pilot that could have helped him. So all of these things contributed to that accident.
And as you say, in many cases, a series of events adds up to a tragedy. And we know that there was some physical evidence remaining afterwards of the loss of this aircraft. And if I'm recalling correctly, you write about actual airplane parts, clothing, even pieces of bodies and a doll,
yeah.
Toys, things like that.
Oh, a tragedy. Yeah. The Coast Guard and the Navy spent a week picking up debris from the lake surface. They knew that it was swirling in the currents and it would eventually come to shore, so they did what they could to pick up all this debris. It was tragic evidence of what happened, a very violent crash with the surface of the lake, even possibly an explosion.
Right.
But these remains are so poignant to think about now. And in fact, what has come to my attention all these years later is a family of one of the victims, Merle Barton. All of his personal possessions were collected floating in the lake or washing ashore on the beach. He was a hairstylist. They found his hairstyling kit, and it was just metal implements that were twisted and rusted. They'd spent time in water and obviously survived this horrible traumatic crash. His suit jacket that's just torn to shreds, a raincoat that has gashes in it, even his checkbook, and we can still read the checkbook register where he purchased his airline ticket for $94. His daughter, who was only two when this happened, has loaned me all these things, and they're now on display in a museum exhibit in South Haven at the Michigan Maritime Museum.
What's the future for your study of this event?
Well, the future is to continue the hunt, although with the writing of the book, I think we have answers, we have some closure. Many of the families I've talked to have more of an understanding now, an acceptance of what happened. But as shipwreck hunters, we just can't give up. We've been out there every good weather day this spring, and we'll continue until conditions on the lake don't allow us to. We've already covered 600 square miles in the past 10 years, and we found 14 shipwrecks in the process. We just haven't found this airplane. So the hunt goes on.
Valerie Van Heest is a Michigan diver and shipwreck hunter, author of Fatal Crossing, The Mysterious Disappearance of Northwest Airlines Flight 2501 and The Quest for Answers, and also author of the recent Michigan History magazine article, Lost Over Lake Michigan. Valerie, thanks for telling the story.
Thank you so much, Peter.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And a brief correction, referring to MSU's corpse flower. The public can view the corpse flower until 8 p.m. this evening. We previously said 7 p.m. That's till 8 o'clock now at the Plant Biology Conservatory, Farm Lane, and Wilson Roads. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll learn about the history of the Stormy Cromer. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment features the 2020 Girls Program, that and more. Tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer, thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also, Aaron Young for engineering, and thanks Nicole Strobel for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us for Current State on WKAR.